Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I asked Peter, before we started on the air here, what is the theme today? And he said, there isn't one.
It's called We Have Some Important Stuff to Bring You, but we can't coordinate it very well.
Yeah. So, but first off, Will Reed, who is the spokesperson for the 50 best world's restaurants, world's 50 best restaurants.
Yeah, I forget it. He has a pretty fancy title. I think basically he's in charge of it.
Yes. And so we thought we'd lead off with him to talk about the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival that's attached now to the world's 50 best restaurants.
Yeah, well, we've talked about Melbourne Food and Wine Festival before.
Yes.
And
But this is an update.
And of course, we're on our way there ourselves anyway in just a few weeks from now. But the synchronization with the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards is a story in and of itself. So we were grateful to have the opportunity to talk to Will and get his understanding of why they decided to do it this way. And I can hardly wait to figure out where they're going to do it next year. maybe they'll come to Pittsburgh next year.
Yeah, right.
maybe not. But anyway, Will is a fine fellow. He runs a great party. He runs a great ship called the World's 50 Best and the World's 50 Best Asia and the World's 50 Best
Latin America.
And I'm sure there'll be a 50 Best somewhere else not too far around the corner.
Thomas Keller, he quipped at one event in London, next, we're going to have the 50 best restaurants in Puerto Rico.
Well, it's possible. If they play, let's make a deal. But anyway, here's Will with the scoop. I think I recall Joe telling us that the world's 50 best restaurants started out as something of kind of like a joke almost. He was sitting down talking to someone, probably you, Will, Drew, about something that could be a feature in a magazine called Restaurant. And you came up with this idea of rating the world's restaurants. Something that most people would feel would require a great deal of trepidation, but you didn't care. You just went straight ahead with it. And the rest, as they say, is history. Where are we now with World's 50 Best?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, it did start out with very humble beginnings as a feature in the magazine. I personally wasn't involved at that time, so it wasn't with me, but all due respect to those guys who came up with the idea, because I think it's fair to say it's been something of a success over the last 15 years.
A sensation might be even a better word for it.
It's certainly grown enormously in terms of the coverage it gets, and also in terms of the importance in the chef world and in the gastronomic world, and as a guide for consumers around the world. And as part of that, as you know, we hosted it in London for many, many years. Last year, for the first time, we moved it outside of London, the World's 50 Best Restaurants event, into New York. And this year we'll be hosting it in Melbourne, Australia. And the reason we're going to Australia is, we thought it would be very exciting. It has an amazing food culture, food and restaurant culture, especially in Melbourne, but also throughout Australia in terms of the produce it can offer, and some amazing chefs and some amazing restaurants. It has a great deal to offer. It's also somewhere that everyone wants to go to. It may be a long way away, but I think all the chef and gastronomic world really want to get there. So we thought it would be a really exciting adventure to take everyone to the other side of the world, and also emphasize the global nature of what we do. You know, we're not just about Western Europe or the USA, and we want the focus to be genuinely international.
Interestingly enough, the story goes that Rahm Emanuel, who is the mayor of Chicago after serving several years in the Obama White House, that he called the president of the James Beard Foundation, and he kept on calling until she agreed to move the awards ceremony to Chicago.
Yeah,
where it is now in its third year, and it's going to be there again next year. Now, I'm guessing that perhaps there might be just a little bit of a backstory that Tourism Australia and Visit Victoria really put a full court press on you to bring your awards to Australia?
Well, I think I don't think they used the kind of Rahm Emanuel tactics, so I don't. His reputation goes before him, but as a very effective operator. What happens is we were in talks with Tourism Australia for a long time regarding this. They certainly wanted to promote their country as a gastronomic destination, but that's it wasn't a case of them simply lobbying us. It's as much a case of us deciding which parts of the world we think would be exciting, viable, attractive for chefs to go to. And keep the excitement and the momentum of the world's 50 best restaurants going and alive and vibrant. So it was a two-way process. Of course, we're in discussions with them, and they've certainly been very helpful in helping put this event on. It has a great deal of challenges doing it when we as an organisation are based in Europe, and so that logistically is a challenge, of course. But we have great partners over in Australia who we're working with, and we think it's going to be the best, world's 50 best restaurants.
Yeah, well, it's also back-to-back and now integrated with the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, which we've been to in the past.
Now, that's a new thing, isn't it? Because previously, World's 50 Best was a special celebration for the chefs in the top 100 and a grand award ceremony, if possible, even more exciting than the Oscars, I think. Because everybody's so thrilled to hear the position that they get into. It's not just one winner. But you've done more to integrate World's 50 Best and a food and wine festival this year. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. Well, again, we actually picked our dates, and then the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival moved their dates in order to coincide with the World's 50 Best restaurants because they wanted to... for it to be one great festival and not to try and compete in terms of attracting consumers and media and chefs at different times. Traditionally, the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival takes place in March, but they shifted it to April with our cooperation and blessing, and now they're a partner of ours. So we work together to create what we hope is going to be a really exciting event program for both Australian consumers, but also for international travellers, for the media as well, and for the chefs. So it's a great opportunity to showcase what Australia's got to offer, but also to bring in lots of the international chefs from all parts of the world into Melbourne.
Now, you've got an integration with a particular series of events, I guess, called the Masterclass. Tell our listeners a little bit more about Masterclass this time around, because previously they've had Masterclass, but the people participating weren't perhaps quite as celebrated as the gang that you guys have managed to put together.
The Masterclass series is something that Melbourne Food and Wine Festival has run for a number of years. This year we discussed how we could be involved in that, and we came up with the idea of doing a masterclass series celebrating the world's 50 best restaurants, and it being the fact that the world's 50 best restaurants is 15 years old this year. So we're celebrating our 15-year anniversary. So we've, between Melbourne Food and Wine and ourselves, we've put together a series of 8 masterclasses over 2 days, including chefs such as Grant Ackers from your neck of the woods, as well as Gaston Acurio from Peru, Zayu Hasegawa from Tokyo, David Thompson, based in Bangkok, but an Australian, and so on. So there's a number of chefs doing masterclasses over the weekend of April 1st and 2nd. Tickets still available if you look on the Melbourne Food and Wine website.
Good. I mean, what is that website?
Oh, now you're testing me.
Okay.
I think it's Melbourne
off the
Food
top
and
of my head.
I think it's melbournefoodandwine.com.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you.
And we'll put it up in the introduction on the website too, so that people can. I mean, we've already put out several things about what's happening, because you keep the chefs in the top 50 and then the top 100 in suspense, but you do announce some of the award recipients ahead of time. And traditionally, I guess the world's best female chef is the first. So you want to tell us a little bit more about that one?
Sure. So we announced that just a couple of weeks ago. And that is Anna Ross from Hisa Franco in Slovenia.
I wonder how many people go to Slovenia. I mean, to tell you the truth, I really...
Yeah. Well, it's little known, but I suspect more people are going to go there. But it's only just over the border from Italy. Yeah,
we've actually eaten in Slovenia, believe it or not.
Yeah, we have. First of all, we stood in Slovenia.
Yeah, we stood right over the line. Anyhow, so we have two famous women now, the First Lady of the United States, and now Anna Ross from Slovenia is the best female chef.
Now she's famous for her cooking rather than for who she's married to, so that's a first positive.
now you've also got a Lifetime Achievement Award coming up somewhere?
That's right. We have the Lifetime Achievement Award, which will be announced on February the 28th, so in a few weeks' time.
I think you also have a Chef's Choice Award too, right?
Yeah, the Chef's Choice Award is announced on the night of the ceremony itself. The other one we announced ahead of time, which we'll do in mid March, so a few weeks before the awards themselves, is the Mille One to Watch Award.
Oh right.
Which goes to a restaurant that's outside of the 50, but that is a rising
Move
star,
up,
if you like. So it tends to be a restaurant that's a bit younger, that hasn't been around so long.
Who was that last year? I forget who it was last year.
Last year's one to watch was Den in Tokyo.
Okay.
That's the chef Sayu Hasegawa, who's actually conducting one of the masterclasses at Melbourne Food and Wine.
Okay. And the year before that, it was the guy in San Francisco.
Saison.
It was Saison in San Francisco. Yeah, the year before, which is now
Skanes.
Last year was on the 50 best list.
Yeah, Skanes. Yeah. He's we ate there when he just started out. I'll tell you, it was nothing like it is now. I mean, it was pretty basic.
I ate there last year, and definitely one of the best meals I had in 2016. Not the best.
Yeah, that'd be your piggy bank, I guess, Will.
Yeah.
I think. Crack open the piggy bank.
Certainly one of the most expensive around.
It is. Seriously been declared the most expensive tasting menu in the States, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you can afford it, it's worth it.
Now, tell us a little bit more about Anna. What is her claim to fame here?
Well, the reason that's really interesting is that she's a self-taught chef who's very gradually built a reputation as one of the most exciting and innovative chefs in the world. So she took over the kitchen of the restaurant that her parents-in-law had owned. She runs it with her husband, who's a sommelier, also a cheesemaker, and also runs the restaurant with her. She started out, effectively as an amateur chef who then stepped into the professional kitchen. But she's a very intelligent, very cerebral lady who has gradually developed her own culinary tone, culinary language, using the local ingredients of Slovenia, a lot of which are unique to to the region and to the beautiful valley in which which the restaurant sits. Some amazing fresh freshwater fish, local cheese, local vegetables and herbs and so on. So she's been a slow burning story, but I think it's now going to attract even more attention from the world. It's a beautiful location, beautiful food, very different food it has influences from the surrounding areas that we might know better, such as Austria, Italy, and so forth. But it's also very much its own style. And I think those people that have eaten there certainly come away delighted with having found something new.
Right.
And it's also much more accessible than it sounds, because it's close to the border with Italy, and you can probably drive there in a little more than 2 hours from Venice.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So just over the border from northeastern Italy, it's close to there, it's close to Austria. It's just because it's a relatively small country that used to be part of the former Yugoslavia, of course, so it's lesser known because it's a young country in that sense. And, you know, during the Yugoslavia years was relatively isolated. It's not geographically far away from you know, some of the major cities of Europe.
Hey, Will, I don't know if this is too soon, early for the event, but you usually get a really high percentage of awardees actually physically attending the award ceremony. How soon do you know that? I mean, is the distance getting to Australia going to make a difference?
I mean, our expectation was that the distance would make a little bit of a difference, so we don't expect to get quite as the same proportion. You know, in the last few years we've had
98%,
so 46-47 over the 50 there. But actually, it's too early to say at the moment, but the indications are looking strong. I think we're going to have a really strong turnout, and, you know, I'm hoping it's going to be up to 90% of the people still coming, even though it's in Australia. So if we do that, we'll be very happy. Hopefully, it's testament to the fact that it's a great event to come to, but also a great week of events.
Yeah, see, I think that's going to be a big draw. Is that there's more than just the one event to come to? I mean,
sure,
it would be a long trip for one award ceremony for a list.
Yeah.
Well, Ann and Peter are going to be there. Promise.
Absolutely. There's lots going on that week, so it's and, you know, it's a beautiful place, beautiful part of the world to go visit.
It is. I mean, we lived there, as you know, and we lived right outside of Melbourne. But I'll tell you, the difference in the food scene from when we lived there and what it is now is just, I mean, it's like light years away.
Well, things move quite fast, and, you know, it's such a kind of dynamic culture. I think that it's really grown very quickly, and there's lots of change all the time, and it keeps it interesting, huh?
Yeah. So, but you were in London. I mean, what's going on there? Anything since we were there in December? Anything happening with the Brexit and everything?
That's a concern. I think, you know, the restaurant world is still trying to work out how that's going to pan out. Too early to say in that sense, but I think there's still a confidence in, you know, eating out culture has only got stronger in recent years. But, you know, my focus is pretty international, so I'm as much looking at what's going on internationally as I am at home, as it were.
Yeah, but I'm worried there won't be anybody waiting tables in London anymore.
Undoubtedly, that's a concern.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you'll know from the US those jobs are often staffed by
Eastern Europeans, mainly.
Non-natives, if you like. So.
Right. Well, Will, I mean, it's going to be exciting no matter what. I mean, I think that it's just a very exciting event, and coupling it with the Melbourne Food and Wine is ingenious, I think.
And we hope, at least I hope, whether Ann shares my opinion, I don't know. We hope that UK restaurants get better representation than they did last year and the year before. We think they're well worthy of more recognition, but who are we to say? It's up to the voters, and we'll see what happens. So we'll see you next Down Under, and look forward to seeing you then.
Thanks, Will.
Very much. Look forward to catching up in Melbourne. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hang in there, listeners, because after a short break, we're going to introduce our interview with Justin Chappell, who's a kitchen gadget freak.
Mad genius tips. Technique.
So that's what's coming up, so don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, welcome back, sweetheart.
Yes, and
who was it again? I've forgotten. I haven't forgotten really because it was only a moment or two ago. But
I'm sure that people have read our next guest column in Food and Wine magazine. And, some might describe him as madcap, which he is, but he's also a mad genius. And things you may never have thought of in your life, he's covered in this book. So that's it, Justin Chappell.
Yeah, he knows about things you need to know about before you even need to know them, right? That was clever. Here's Justin.
Justin Chappell. Mad genius tips. I thought I wouldn't ask you this, but I'm going to ask you anyhow. Were you the class clown when you were in school?
I was a little bit of a class clown, yes. So I think you've hit the nail on the head there.
You have a good time. And this book shows how much fun you have. You goofy shots you have here, like stacking all these mason jars. And it's going to fall over any minute, you know.
Yeah, that was actually when we shot that picture. It was a little scary for me because at one point I had the mason jars stacked so high that they really were about to fall. And then our photographer, who's very talented, his name is John Koenig, he walks over and just puts another mason jar right on top. It was so scary.
Well, this Mad Genius Tips, you say, started out as a video series. Take us back and what made you decide to do this? Now, are you a chef?
Yeah, well, I was a line cook for a while in French restaurants here in New York City.
Okay.
I studied culinary arts at the French Culinary Institute, which is now known as the International Culinary Center.
Yeah, but, poor Dorothy, huh?
I know. Gosh, yeah. It's just such a sad thing. But, you know, she left an incredible mark on the world.
Oh, she sure did. And we've interviewed her a lot, yeah.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman.
So, but go ahead now. So you have that degree under your belt, and then you end up at Food and Wine. Is that what happened?
Yeah, so I was working in restaurants, and then I got this wonderful opportunity at Food and Wine, and that was 7 years ago. And it's been a really great ride. And you know, about 5 years ago is when we started the Mad Genius Tips video series, and we're really looking for a way to reinvent how-to videos. How-to videos were available everywhere, but we wanted to create a new series that was really, really fun and kind of out of the ordinary and fun, funny in addition to being fun. And that's kind of how we ended up with Mad Genius Tips, and I created these kind of really wacky tips for preparing ingredients, and we continue to shoot the videos, and we've got a wonderful response from people, and we love doing them, and we've shot about almost 100, I think, episodes of the show.
Well, how do you come up with these things? I mean, you organize this book, you're like, here's this chapter called Aluminum Foil, okay, and then you talk about these things that you can do to solve problems with it, and then you move on to bundt pans, and then, well, I mean, what leads you to these? Do you start out with the object, or do you start out with the problem, or the what?
Well, actually, so when I would work on the videos, I would, because I work my I like to call it my day job. My day job is, you know, I'm a recipe tester and developer for Food and Wine magazine, and so I spend a lot of time just cooking every single day, and I learn a lot of really smart tips from chefs, and I learn a lot of smart tips from cookbook authors and bloggers, and a lot of them I develop myself, you know, as a way of doing something easier or quicker. And so that's kind of how we develop these ideas for the video series, is I just come up with them at work, or I learn them from friends or other people in the industry. But, you know, when we decided to turn the video series into a cookbook, we looked at it and we said, you know, this cookbook needs to be different. It needs to be something really fun and out of the ordinary, because that's what the videos are all about. And when we started talking about how to organize the book, I thought, you can't just put the recipes into the book as you would a traditional cookbook, because then you lose a sense of what makes this book special. And, you know, we had a lot of conversations about what to do, and we decided that when looking at all the content that we wanted to put in the book, we figured out that a lot of the ideas and a lot of what made it fun was that the star of a lot of the tips are is actually the tool that you use. And what I realized was there was, you know, 25 tools that I used in all these different ways. And so we decided, that's kind of what we decided to do, was to say, you know, here are 25 tools. They're essential in the kitchen, and I'm going to teach you how to do more with less. I'm going to teach you how to have fun when you're cooking and show you that each piece of equipment that you have in the kitchen can actually be used for various tasks and various techniques that maybe are really unexpected.
Well, that's probably how we got microplane, isn't it?
Oh, totally. I'm sure that's how a lot of some of the really special kitchen equipment, some of the stuff that we maybe take for granted nowadays, were invented, because somebody said, you know, there's got to be a way to do this
exactly
better.
Well, we know the story of microplane anyway. It turns out that it was a woodworking tool, but Mrs. Joe something or other in Chicago got fed up with trying to zest things. So she took her husband's rasp out of his workshop, and a whole new tool was born. Now, is that sort of like the way it works with the inside of your head, or?
I think, you know, I think so, a little bit. You know, what's funny, though, is, just to give you an example, so, you know, one of my favorite pieces of equipment in the kitchen, and there's a whole chapter based around this tool in the book, is a baking rack.
You do wonderful things with that. I never knew what to do with a baking rack.
So, I mean, you know, a lot of people bake on it, but then a lot of people just cool their cookies on it. And, you know, you have this piece of equipment in your house, and you might as well, you know, take advantage of it the best way you can. And so I actually learned a really fun tip from one of my friends who's a chef. His name's Jamie Bissonnette. He's a chef in New York City.
Yeah, we know Jamie. We've interviewed him.
Yeah, Jamie is such an amazing person. He's so nice, and he's got a lot of great ideas. And, you know, he told me one day, he said, because he watches the show, watches my web series, and he said, you know, you should do this. And he said, you know, whenever you want to chop a ton of eggs at one time, if you're making egg salad or something like that, he says, instead of, you know, chopping it on a cutting board, just press it right through your baking rack, and then you could put it right into your serving bowl or your mixing bowl, and the only piece of, you know, the only thing you have to wash now is your baking rack and your bowl instead of a cutting board and a knife and then a bowl.
You know, I haven't tried that. I read it in your book, but I haven't actually tried that to see if it works.
Oh, it definitely works, and it's kind of amazing. But, and you know, back to your question about if that's how my mind works. So I think that if I was somebody who was looking to make a crazy business out of this, I think I might see that trick and say, you know, what can I create that's like an egg chopper? But those things exist out there. But I guess my whole point in this, and what I think makes the book so unique, is that it shows that, you know, you don't need to go out and buy these single-use kitchen tools.
You know,
when you can use the stuff you have at home already.
Well, I have to say that I did gift guide, which I hate gift guides anyhow, but I decided to do one on funny things, I mean, which I think are just stupid, you know, gadgets for the kitchen. I included this thing, which is, it's a plastic sort of oval dish with a rim across the center, and it's called Crack'em. It's for cracking eggs.
Oh my gosh, that is so hysterical.
the guy who invented it, wasn't he a Marine or something like that?
He was a Marine, and he was on
so prep. So we had this special advice for him, don't quit your day job.
Oh my gosh,
I mean, he sold them, like, you could buy five for $2 or something. I don't know what it was. But the only thing I ever found a good use for it is my cleaning woman used it for a soap dish.
I was going to say, or you could put your rings in it when you're doing dishes.
Exactly. But you're not trying to be Alton Brown, and you're not trying to be Kenji, right?
No, absolutely not. I'm just, you know, I'm just a regular test kitchen guy who's looking to have a lot of fun and teach you to do more with less.
Great.
Now let's talk about chickens for a second.
Oh, Peter's favorite thing. You usurped his favorite
you didn't usurp it exactly. I'm not sure. I think my device maybe works better, but that's the bundt pan.
Oh, yes, when I cook the chicken in the bundt pan.
Yeah, the beer can chicken.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of what inspired the idea, is beer canned chicken, because I was actually testing a recipe for a story we did probably a year and a half ago, and it was a recipe called Dr. Pepper Chicken. And so this person, you know, made beer canned chicken, but they did it with a can of Dr. Pepper. And I thought when I made it, what I loved about the idea was that because the chicken was standing up, the back of it got crispy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, oh my gosh, you could probably do this in a butt pan.
See, I haven't checked that either. Is the opening wide enough on a chicken?
Yeah, it actually is. But what I do, you know, is I cover the tube of the butt pan, I cover it with foil, and then and this is actually really important when you do this, is you fill the bottom of the butt pan with vegetables or food.
Yeah,
I have
saw
a couple
that.
Recipes. Yeah, and the reason you do that, there's two reasons you do that. The first reason is it props the chicken up, and so it lifts it up higher than the edge of the pan so that the air circulates around it. But then it also, all the food that you put in there catches all those delicious chicken juices, and it's almost like a one-pot meal. So I have a couple recipes in the Mad Genius Tips cookbook that I love. One of them is roast chicken with sausage and peppers.
Yeah,
it's kind of
and
it's really delicious. And so you fill the bottom with Italian sausage and all these different kinds of peppers and onions. And then when you cook the chicken, all the delicious chicken juices marry with all the juices from the sausage and the peppers. And you get this roast chicken with all these vegetables and this delicious jus, which I just love it. And another one of the recipes that I do with that is I fill the butt pan with little baby potatoes, and the potatoes catch all the juices and get
yeah,
nice
well,
and
that's like the
delicious.
We call it Speedo chicken in Italy. They have all the rotisserie chickens, and the potatoes are always underneath.
The potatoes on the bottom catching all the fat.
Yeah.
They're
actually even more into that in Spain.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, I think in France they call it potato boulangère.
Uh-huh.
There
where
you go.
They,
yes, yep, yep.
Where they have the chickens roasting over all the sliced potatoes. So delicious.
Well, I mean, I have to tell you, I have a bundt pan, and I don't bake, so I never knew what to do with it.
No, it's my turn. It's my turn. You see, you're going to have to do a little bit of research here, because you've forgotten that one of the purposes of beer can chicken, or Dr. Pepper chicken for that matter, is to infuse your chicken with the taste of the liquid.
Oh, well, definitely.
So for that, you need my beer can chicken machine.
You have one.
I really have one. Somebody actually made it. Somebody wrote a book called The Zen of Beer Can Chicken.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of theirs was so inspired that he created a device made out of different pieces of sheet metal. But the prong is long and narrow. And then underneath the surface is a reservoir where you can put the beverage of your choice.
Oh, wow.
And instead of circulating only once, like the beer can version where you just jam the beer can in the chicken's backside and let it drain, this circulates the liquid continuously during the cooking process, and you can make a gravy with it when you're done.
Oh, wow, that's so smart. I'm going to have to look into that.
So I can't remember where I got it from. It was a long time ago. If you Google beer can chicken machine, you might or might not find one. Or probably somewhere in your kitchen drawer is a device you can use that will serve the same purpose.
Yeah, I'm gonna definitely look into that. I might have to order one just to test it out here at Food and Wine.
I really suffer from the lack of a decent cherry pitter. I have been through so many different kinds of cherry pitters, and the woman who owned the a local kitchen supply shop said that her favorite one was this wine bottle with the chopstick thing that you talk about. But that's still a lot of work, isn't it?
You know, it's actually not. I've had the same problem. Actually, part of how I developed that tip or came across that tip is because I was making a cherry pie at Food and Wine, and I was using our cherry pitter, but we had this really I want to call it an antique. I don't think it's an antique, but we had a very old cherry pitter that I think has been at Food and Wine since we probably started. And it was a little rusty, and when I was trying to pit the cherries, at one point it actually snapped. Like, it snapped in half, and then I was like, oh my gosh, I have to make this pie. What am I going to do? And I didn't want to smash the cherries because they were very soft. So, you know, I did a little bit of research. I was Googling, and I saw that somebody was using a paper clip to do it, and I tried that, and that didn't work. And then I said, well, can't I just press it out, like push it out with a chopstick? And then, of course, I saw somebody doing it with a wine bottle, and I said, oh my gosh, this is brilliant. So,
still,
and it worked really well.
In Australia, we saw somebody who did, she had a bed and breakfast, and she sold baked goods, and she had some wonderful, but I'm sure very expensive, German contraption for bulk cherries. She put all the cherries in this thing, and somehow she got pitless cherries out of it. But I never been able to find it.
That's kind of amazing, though. That would be spectacular. Especially if you know, I have a country house up in the Catskills, and a lot of my neighbors, you know, they go sour cherry picking.
Oh, that's wonderful, huh?
Yeah, but they buy, I think, like 30 pounds of sour cherries, and I just don't know how they pit them all.
Well, I don't either.
One at a time, it's called.
Yeah, one at a time.
You get
all
blisters.
You can do. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, I mean, this is fun. I mean, that's your intention here is to make it fun.
Oh, I thought he took it all very seriously.
He does take it seriously, but it's still fun. I mean, I'm anxious to do the spiral cut hot dogs. That's one of
those are really fun.
Yeah, and this Hasselback is ingenious. That's another one I'm going to use.
And you know, it's interesting because the Hasselback actually comes from the name of a restaurant that invented it in, I believe, like probably like 50 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
It was one of the ones in L.A.
I think it was in Europe. I believe it was definitely in Europe. Yeah. But yeah, so that's kind of where that idea of Hasselbacking originated. But it's such a great thing, and I do it with not only the potatoes, but I also Hasselback apples, and you can pretty much Hasselback anything that you might want to.
And all you
cut
need
in
is two chopsticks.
Yeah, all you need is two chopsticks, and such a smart and it makes you know a really nice presentation, especially if you do little fingerling potatoes.
Yep, I think it's pretty. Well, listen, you're full of ideas, and it's really inspiring to talk to you about it because it makes you be more attentive to ways of simplifying your life if you cook.
Yeah.
So I'm anxious to try out some of these, and I'll let you know.
Oh, thank you. I would love to hear any feedback you have, or if either of you have a Mad Genius tip of your own, I'd love for you to share it with me because I'm always looking for new ideas, and you never know.
Well, we'll become best buddies. That's great.
Yes, for sure. And you know, I really do hope you enjoyed the book. It was a lot of fun to make, and you know, back to your point about me having fun, I think that the book itself is a lot of fun because the tips are fun, and I think we make it a little more serious by offering, you know, just really delicious recipes to go with
the hack. Thank you, because I wanted to point that out before we left. It's not just the tips, but the recipes themselves are really cool.
Right, and that's why we were like, but how do we provide a service, you know, and the tips are obviously, you know, they provide information and they provide really something fun to do. But, you know, when you're making a book and you want people to go back to it over and over again, it's like, what do you do? And we said, you know, you put really awesome, delicious recipes with it, and then it gives people a reason to want to go back to it and want to revisit it and use it again and again.
You're right there. Thanks, Justin, for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me. You have no idea. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And I always love talking to our next guest, Raghavan Iyer, who is written this book that, of course, it's the subject is something I'm mad for, my favorite food.
It's the subject that Anne adores.
Potatoes. the title is Smash, Smash, Boiled and Baked and Fried Too. And I'll tell you, finished reading this book and talking to him, I've now begun to think of potatoes as healthy and loaded with vitamins.
So there. Not only that, they taste good too.
They taste wonderful.
So here's
Raghavan Iyer.
By special request, this is Peter introducing a program about one of Anne's favorite things in the whole world. But first of all, let's say that most of the world seems to think that potatoes were originated in Ireland. and then if you go to Peru, they will prove that that's absolutely false, because they have 100,000 different varieties of potatoes in the form of seed. We went to Minneapolis. Of course, you go there next for an expert called Raghavan Iyer, who just wrote a book all about potatoes. It's called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, Baked, and Fried in small letters. We're glad that McDonald's managed to get Freedom Fries in there. But seriously, Raghavan, you're clearly not Irish.
No, I'm not.
I don't think you're Incan from Peru. So how come this lifelong interest in potatoes?
I've always said, you know, first of all, I should probably change my last name and I should call myself McIyer, because I think it's such a passion of mine. It has been. You asked when this started, and this started 55 years ago, you know, that's how old I am. And it's one of those vegetables that was such a strong presence in my mother's kitchen. And, you know, if you think about it now, you know, two of the countries that produce the world's largest amount of potatoes are India and China.
I didn't know that.
And in fact, you know, potatoes, of course, did not come to India until the 16th century. Thanks to the Spanish and the Portuguese settlers. And the New World, they introduced us to the world of potatoes, along with chilies and tomatoes. And so this is something that, you know, my mother, when she was alive, I mean, every meal that she made, you know, usually had potatoes in one form or the other. And I remember my earlier memories was, you know, every time, you know, she being the youngest male child in the family, you know, I always got preferential treatment. And so she would always ask me what I wanted for a meal, and my answer would always be potatoes in one form or the other. And I think finally she sort of stopped asking because she knew what the answer was going to be anyway. Yeah. So
take really well to Indian spices. Peter's favorite dish came out of Houston, and it was an Indian chef, and she made
The main ingredient was fenugreek.
Fenugreek. Mm-hmm. Potatoes. Mm-hmm. He's never met the likes of.
I looked in the index, and there is no recipe for fenugreek flavored potatoes.
Not in this book, but actually I do have that recipe in one of my previous books, which was titled 660 Curries.
Oh, is it in there?
We have that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll find it in there.
Okay, well, yeah, that's the book Adam, our son, wanted.
Tonight's potatoes are yellow potatoes, as Anne said, but they're going to go with skate wing, and they're going to be seasoned with fenugreek and...
Turmeric. Did you buy the root?
I have a little bit of fresh.
Okay, we love the fresh root.
Yeah, fresh turmeric is really amazing. The flavors are incredible. And you're right, it does go beautifully well with potatoes. And I feel, you know, potatoes are a perfect sort of a medium in showcasing, you know, anything and everything you want it to be. But I think what makes potatoes so unique is it still maintains its uniqueness. And so you still enjoy and you revere the potato. And so I always felt, you know, no matter what recipe I created in the book, I wanted to sort of put the potato on a pedestal, and so that was the focus of the book.
Well, Wendy, you start out explaining your fascination with potatoes, but then you actually take us through a little tutorial on the various types, and I had never thought of so many various types, and you didn't even include all of them, you just included obvious ones that people would have access to. But I should have known, because we went to the Potato Institute, as I said, in Lima, Peru, and we were just blown away by the varieties of potatoes.
And the one of the really interesting things, and I'm sure, of course, you know this yourself, but I didn't realize that potatoes can actually be grown from seeds. Now, when I was growing up, my father used to grow potatoes in our little allotment, and he did it. He started out with an eye of a potato attached to a bit of potato itself. So it wasn't being done from the original seed. But in fact, you can do that, correct?
Yes, you can. And in fact, you know, I also had the opportunity to actually spend some time with a potato research scientist in Canada, in the New Brunswick province.
Yes.
And she walked me through, you know, the sort of the birds and the bees of what it takes for a potato to come to fruition. And, you know, they actually would produce, you know, new breeds and new varietals by seeds that were taken out of, you know, plants that were bred by natural plant breeding methods. And then the seeds were then planted, and, you know, so they sort of went through the whole process of it. So, and that's how, what was surprising to me was, you know, when I was chatting with her. In the book, I have a story about her that I call her the Potato Whisperer.
Yes.
And she is, you know, her passion was so clear, and I learned so much in that short time period. And it surprised me to learn that for a potato varietal to come into the marketplace, it takes anywhere from 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, now, I thought it was all done by grafting, because we've interviewed apple breeders and what were those things, the plum cots or whatever they were, breeders, and I knew how long it took, but I thought they did everything by grafting, not by seeds.
Yeah, no, this one, particularly, you know, when she, her job has, you know, is really to come up with new varietals. And so to come up with those, you know, seeds play a very big role for them. And so it's the seeds that she procures from her methods, and then she sows those seeds in trays in sort of a controlled environment. And, you know, that's how they, and then they go further on, and they're tested for, you know, the soil conditions and the weather conditions and so on. So
she cross-pollinates, right?
Yes, she does. And
what's the difference between a male and a female?
Well, I know that's a trick question there, but I know
that. Beats the shit out of me.
Well, I think whatever the answer is, the correct answer, it's the women that are superior.
here was some interesting stuff that we found out at the Potato Institute in Peru. They were actually working on a potato that would thrive when there wasn't very much sun. So essentially they were wrapping the atmosphere away from the potatoes.
I think one of the
things that was important was, you know, when with all these methods and this testing to come up with varietals, you know, that withstand, you know, multiple soil conditions and multiple temperature conditions, because, you know, of course, they also did not want potatoes that, you know, were exposed to disease and pests. And so when you think about Ireland, you know, and the entire country,
the famine,
was, you know, because of the blight. And so that annihilated crops, and millions of people died, and, you know, because of their strong reliance for that one potato. So it was, you know, they certainly don't want that to happen again. So
we have that in with our tomatoes in the backyard. I don't know how to get rid of them.
Another thing we learned is that potatoes are very good, and they're amazing in that they grow above like 15,000 feet in the Andes. But the natives who live there and who grow the potatoes there,
they freeze them.
That's all they eat. But that's all they eat.
Mm-hmm. But they freeze them. Well, it's like freeze dry.
They freeze them because it's cold.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Dr. Birdseye would be pleased, you know.
I think also the important point I think that you made with that statement was that it's the nutrition of the potato. People sometimes forget that it's a very, very nutritious vegetable.
Yeah, and tell us about that. You have it in your book.
Yeah,
and I was reading it thinking, ha ha, I'm justified now.
What they were working on, they had a crew who were working on the fact that potatoes are very good for you in general, but they don't have enough mm-hmm. zinc, and there's another mm-hmm. vitamin that they don't have enough
zinc
of.
Zinc was the missing piece.
So they mm-hmm. were working on potatoes that were optimized for containing more zinc and more of this vitamin.
More zinc, Because the potato, you know, is a very, very fantastic source for complex carbohydrate. You know, these are your good carbs that your body needs.
Right.
And it converts them to energy and not sugars. And so I think that was a big, you know, that's one of the things people always talk, oh, you know, potato carbs, that's not very good. But these are the good carbs that your body really needs. Yeah. And also it is a great source of vitamin C, and it's got high levels of potassium and magnesium.
And it's not in the skin, you point out.
It's just a few millimeters under the skin, actually. And so, that's why when they say, you know, it's healthy to eat the skin, it's just a few millimeters under the skin that makes it very healthy. And, you know, some of the darker variety colors of potatoes actually have higher levels of antioxidants.
Yes.
Which is, you know, which of course, you know, some of the newer varieties like the Peruvian purple, for instance, you know, it's also a potato that is so gorgeous to look at, and it's also very healthy for you. So, I do, and that's a varietal now that is much more common in grocery stores. And so, what can I say? This is, I live and breathe potatoes, and I still do it every day, actually. So it's a big part of my diet.
Now, I'm not so crazy about sweet potatoes, actually, although mm-hmm. when I get into them, I like them. It's just thinking about them. I don't think mm-hmm. of them with the same kind of reverence that I think of my other potatoes.
No, because, you know, sweet potatoes actually have nothing to do with potatoes,
right.
And they are a totally different species. And the only reason I included a few sweet potato recipes in there was when my editor and I had a conversation. She thought it would be nice to include a few sweet potato recipes in there. And so I saved a fair amount of it for the dessert, but, you know, potatoes are part of the nightshade group of family of plants, like, you know, think tomatoes, that plant.
Yeah, which I'm not supposed to be eating because of the osteoarthritis, actually.
Ah, okay.
But I do anyhow. I couldn't live with that tomatoes. I couldn't live with that tomatoes.
But let's go back to this lovely book, because it's got this column on the right-hand side called Tater Tips. And these tater tips, you must have just had such a wonderful time figuring out what to put in each one of them.
Yeah, this was, you know, and I think a part of that, you know, the whole part of the tater tips is I feel, you know, it's also a reflection of the fact that I've been teaching for 25 years. And as a cooking teacher, you know, the best thing I can do is to arm my students with enough information for them to feel successful in whatever it is that you're doing. So, you know, whether it be
I learned from
it. Yeah, thank you. And that's a piece of it I feel that makes the book so approachable and unique, is you can actually take it to bed and read it, and you know, you feel like you're getting a lot of information, which is wonderful to see. So that I felt was an integral part of, and every book that I write really is a reflection of what I learned from students. And so things that I may take for granted, you know, and somebody would ask me a question, it's like, oh wow, it certainly is not as clear as I thought it was going to be. So it just gives me an opportunity to expound a little bit more on a particular ingredient or technique. So yeah, those tater tips are.
I bet everybody loves your salted chocolate chips.
What's not to love, Anne, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You take potatoes and you dip it in dark chocolate and you sprinkle it with a little bit of lavender sea salt. I think that combination is dynamite. And once in a while, actually, you know, I'll have that for dessert, and I'll serve it when I have guests, I'll serve it with a bowl of even a nice, simple premium ice cream, and the combination is really terrific.
Give me some insight as to why this Russian salad is so popular, like in Spain and all around. I mean, first of all, it's not even Russian. I mean, Anna von Brunzian about that, because she was into Spanish food for a period of time there, and she's Russian.
Yes.
And she didn't even know how it became popular and known as Russian salad.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, again, I look at this as more of a hodgepodge of cultural influences that shape this. And, you know, perhaps I think one of the reasons is, you know, a lot of people in Russia were, you know, made it a particular way. And so the inclusion of anchovies and, you know, it's one of those classic, you know, homemade mayonnaise salads, which, and this particular recipe in my book, comes from a very close friend and colleague of mine. And, you know, his grandmother, Ida, was the one who used to make the salad all the time. And, you know, with her influences from that part of the world, she really, you know, punctuated that salad with, you know, everything from fresh dill and anchovies and cucumbers and scallions. And so it had such more of a lively, you know, character to that salad. And I just think that the flavors come through beautifully well. And yeah, in spite of using all of those multitude of ingredients, I still feel you can enjoy the potatoes that are in that, you know, particular recipe. And for that one, I used new red potatoes, you know, which are just gorgeous.
Yeah.
So
I'm sure we could negotiate a peace with the Iranians, the Persians, if only we would all eat Persian-style potatoes and eggs.
Yes. You know, it's such an important point you made, is the fact that, you know, food is such a common binder in terms of bringing cultures together. And I just feel like we have multiple disparate cultures and thoughts that can come to a table. And with the medium of food, I feel like, and especially with the medium of potatoes, I feel like, you know, you can address so many issues and come to, you know, at least some sort of a discussion that makes it much easier to move ahead.
And here's the very next recipe, chorizo stuffed hash browns. I have a feeling over this one we could probably reach agreement on who's going to pay for the wall. You didn't think about that, did you?
I had no inclination about that when I wrote the book. And hopefully there is no wall.
Right, exactly.
Cooking without borders, I think that to me is the beauty of cooking internationally. And I just, you know, in times like these, I just find myself cooking more and more, you know. It keeps you grounded, and it just makes you, it's cathartic. And so I think we need that in such times, yeah.
Let me ask you one more thing here. There's always a raging debate about the best method for cooking French fries.
Yes.
I mean, what's his name? The guy from the Serious Eats, what's his name? Kenji.
Kenji Lopez, yeah.
Yeah, Kenji devoted a whole article on the French fries. And, you know, he scientifically explores, I mean, you know, he's the patience of a saint, you know, doing all these tests. And his conclusion at the exact temperatures, you have to cook them twice, I think, or did he say three times?
Three times, he said.
And where do you come down with this?
I tried many techniques, and I feel like, you know, for the home cook, the cooking it twice works well, but after the first initial cooking at a lower temperature, around 325, you know, when you're barely cooking it in that oil till it's not brown yet, but, you know, it still maintains its whiteness, I take it out of the oil, and as it's, dripping on a rack, I take a little bit of cornstarch and I dust it lightly with cornstarch, and then I return that. I put all those potatoes into the freezer, and so that nice chill. And then, you know, when I'm ready to fry them again, I get the oil to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and then I take the potatoes right out of the freezer and put it right into that hot oil.
That sounds good.
And then, you know, yeah, and then within minutes, you know, it comes out beautiful, and it's crispy, and it's nice and caramel brown on the outside, and inside it's nice and tender. And the crunch remains because of that little cornstarch that I added.
Yeah, I noted that recipe, and I think that for that, I sort of socked that away for future reference. It seems to me like it would work. Yeah, I tried doing the souffle potatoes several times. I gave up on those.
You can't, in a domestic kitchen, you can't get the fat hot enough.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't get it up there where you'd like it to be. I mean, you'd like it to be over 500 degrees if you could stand it. And I am known, by the way, for my fried potatoes.
Well, then, you know what? I should be the judge, and I should come over, and you can cook for me.
Come on over. We'll be waiting for
you. But, you know, I noticed your latke recipe, and he's known also for his latkes. The grandchildren love his latkes. Granddad, please make his latkes. Our daughter-in-law does not like his latkes because he sets off the smoke detector. And the kids probably love that the most of all, because they giggle like crazy as everybody's trying to open the windows.
the last time I fried potatoes for them, I fried like 3 pounds of potatoes. I got into trouble for something else. I put the potatoes in a huge skillet on a trivet, on a wooden trivet, and it burned
the trivet.
Oh, no.
That's amazing. You're always in trouble.
I felt like things better than burning your island.
Like I said, I have a feeling that, you know, again, I've always said it's the woman that is very much of a superpower.
we better not go any further with that. We're only going to get into trouble. Hey,
I'm always fun to talk to you, Relevant.
Yeah, go give Mary Tyler Moore a hug for us.
I will. I'll give her a big hug, and hopefully, you know, whenever I see her again, that we'll be sharing a plate of potatoes.
You wouldn't happen to be going to the 50 Best or anything this year. You're going to Melbourne? Everybody's going to Melbourne.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Mm-hmm. And so I've got I will be coming out to the East Coast next week, and so I'll be doing some events there. So,
where are you going to be? You want to plug
them? I will be in Boston, Vermont, and Maine. I'm also going to be doing a cooking class at the King Arthur Flour Cooking School.
Great.
And so it'll be a class all on potatoes, but it'll be actually some of the recipes that involve baking, and so it should be a fun class. So,
do you have a website where people can track where you're going to be?
I do, and it's raghavanayer.com.
Got it. Okay, I bet you didn't have a fight over an internet squatter over that name.
No, I did not. I have had this website for a long time, and I was fortunate that I was the only Raghavanayer who decided to have a website back then. What a pleasure to talk to the two of you. So, and I look forward to chatting with you again. And so thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Who knew there was so much to know about potatoes? But of course we did, as we discussed in the interview itself. Since we've been to the home of the potato,
in Peru
and places all over the world where they love this particular. Is it a vegetable? I guess it's a vegetable.
It certainly is. It's so a root there. Vegetable, actually.
Good.
Maybe
anyway,
it's a tuber.
That's it. That's enough. That's enough for this week. Tuber or not, it's time to say goodbye, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.